So I'm going to welcome on his brother, Norman Otis Richmond, who is originally from Arcadia, Louisiana. And I want to kind of just go off script. I've been reading Norman's work for quite some time on Black Agenda Report. I've listened to his radio broadcasts on Uhura Radio. He's a musicologist, and I'm going off script. He's a musicologist. The brother knows anything and everything when it comes to music, and especially Black music. And that's why we welcome him on, help him on this program. And so whether it's jazz, blues, soul, he knows it. And we're going to talk to him about the history of Black music. We're going to talk to him about how Black music was co-opted by white folks and white corporations. And also, most importantly, what Black folks, Africans need to do to reclaim African music in the U.S. He's an organizer. He has a long history of organizing. He refused to fight in the Vietnam War because he felt like the Vietnamese and Africans, were united, which they were. After leaving Los Angeles, he lived in Los Angeles in the 60s, and after leaving Los Angeles in the 60s, Norman Richmond moved to Toronto, where he co-founded the Afro-American Progressive Association, which is one of the first Black power organizations in that part of the world, one of the first. So this man is an organizer. That's what I'm talking about, doing it. That's what I'm talking about, people. If you don't create an organization, then join one that's about something. Don't just run around. Norman wasn't running around chanting the empty rhetoric and wearing a daishiki and so forth. He was saying, you know what? If I do those things, those things need to be anchored by actions. And so he was doing that. Norman also worked with the Detroit-based League of Revolutionary Black Workers. He was the youngest member of the central staff. The league was a part of the movement that included the Revolutionary Action Movement, otherwise known as RAM, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, otherwise known as SNCC, the Black Panther Party, the Republic of New Africa, All African Revolutionary Party, and the African People's Socialist Party. In 1992, Richmond received the Toronto Arts Award. In front of that audience, when he received that award, in part of the audience was the mayor of Toronto. Richmond dedicated his award, and this is really big because in front of that entire audience, whether it was mainstream politicians or not, he said that he dedicated that award to Mumia Abu-Jamal, Asada Shakur, Geronimo Pratt, late great Geronimo Pratt, the African National Congress of South Africa, Fidel Castro, and the people of Cuba. Richmond began his career as a journalist, and he worked for the African Canadian Weekly Contrast, and he went on to be published in the Toronto Star, the Toronto Globe, the Mail, Toronto Globe and Mail, the National Post, the Jaskin Advocate, The Islander. I mean, we can go on and on. The Pan-African Newswire, Black Agenda Report, where you can find a lot of his pieces. He's internationally. He's also written for United Nations, the Jamaican Gleaner, The Nation, which is a paper in Barbados, and Pambazuka News. So without further ado, and sometimes people think that, intros are long-winded. I in this instance, believe that this intro is just and perhaps does not even come close to even doing the man's work and the man himself justice. So without further ado, welcome on to Your World News, Norman Otis Richmond.
Oh, thank you for that introduction. I don't know who you were talking about.
Yeah. We're talking about you. And we appreciate you calling in from Toronto. And I just actually, before we even, get started with the interview itself in terms of what we want to ask you, I just want to ask you, what did Nelson Mandela mean to you? And maybe you can even talk about since you have adoration for Fidel Castro and the people of Cuba, you can't separate the people of Cuba and Fidel Castro from Nelson Mandela, what they mean to you as well.
Well, I remember Nelson Mandela. I know there, the mainstream press is not going to talk about this, but I remember Nelson Mandela as an ally of Fidel Castro, as an ally of Muammar Gaddafi, as an ally of the Palestinian Liberation Organization when Yasser Arafat was ahead of it. And I remember Nelson Mandela, who was trained in Algeria. And, you know, Algeria is a country where you had a man by the name of Ahmed Ben Bella, who was the head of the movement there. And that is where the Black Panther Party had their international office in Algiers. And, you know, I remember Mandela in those, like that, but I know that the mainstream press probably is not going to deal with that. They're going to deal with the fact that he met the Dalai Lama and he did this and he did, you know what I mean? They're gonna water him down like they do anyone that's that was really struggling. They always water you down. Like Martin Luther King, we know that a year before Martin Luther King was killed, he was public enemy number one. But now when they talk about Martin Luther King, he might as well be Prophet Muhammad or Jesus, you know, the way they talk about him.
Right. Thank you. I appreciate that. I wanted to just ask you, to get a broad overview on, you talk about, you know, your research, you know, and your studies with the history of Black music, and you know, why have you spent so many years studying Black music itself?
My father was a music fanatic, and all of his children have basically, and I inherited that from my father, and I happened to try to sing at one point, and I recorded music, and I, you know, I cut records and so on and so forth, and I was always getting into trouble with these groups because, you know, and you know, when I was 14 years old, I went to the Muhammad's Mosque number 27. And that kind of, you know, I didn't join at that particular time, but you know, I was really deeply influenced, and I was always kind of outspoken, and I really couldn't stay in groups a lot of times because I was always be talking about, as they say, this Black stuff, and you know, a lot of times, a lot of guys at that time wanted to get money and get women. And a lot of them wanted to get white women, you know, and I was talking this Black nationalist stuff, so, you know, it always got me, you know, got me into trouble. But music, my father basically turned me on to music, and after Malcolm was, you know, assassinated, I got really interested in the, you know, the history of African people, and music was just a part of it.
Thank you, Norman. Can you tell us the true history behind rock and roll? Because a lot of folks don't know that rock and roll itself is an African creation. You know, there was Africans in the Americas, like Chuck Berry, who are the original, you know, fathers of rock and roll. Can you talk to us about that, and how did, you know, and how did rock and roll become, you know, come to be named rock and roll, and why, and who were the folks that you know, usurped it and kind of renamed it what, you know, what it is today?
Well, I think they give the credit for Alan Freed for coining the term rock and roll, but Alan Freed was a DJ out of I think he was out of Cleveland, and he was kind of a mix. He had kind of a mixed bag because he promoted a lot of Black music, basically, and he had something to do with the Moonglows. I think he's quoted, or he's maybe credited with co-writing Sincerely, which I don't think he had anything to do with that, but he was tight with the folks, and you know, he was indicted for pill and all that kind of stuff, but they basically like demonized him. But you know, rock and roll was, you know, created by, you know, Ike Turner did a lot of things around rock and roll. But you know, when we think about rock and roll, we should think about Chuck Berry, Little Richard, Bo Diddley, and these are the people that really created that form. And then the press and the society made Elvis Presley the king of rock and roll. But as we know, the king and queen of rock and roll is Little Richard. And we have, you know, and the, I've been seeing, I saw this movie Muscle Shoals, and I saw this film 20 Feet from Stardom. And, you know, all of those, basically, if you see those films, you'll basically see that our people have created this music, but we've been used in the sense that we never get the credit. Like if you go to YouTube and you look at the 20 Feet from Stardom, you will see Mick Jagger is on the trailer. You know, then you open it up with, you know, the people talking are like Bruce Springsteen and, you know, and folks like that. Now, to give credit to Bruce Springsteen, he's basically saying that these are the originators and should be given the credit, you know. But I have problems with Mick Jagger because I don't really think that I think he's gotten too much credit, and he's been very shrewd in terms of being able to attract the first song that the first hit they had was a Bobby Womack song. It's, you know, it's all over now. They were able to use the reggae music. They were able to use African music, and he has a good ear, and he knows which way the wind is blowing. So, you know, black music is rock and roll music is African based music, and we just don't get the credit for it.
Thank you, Norman. My next question is, could you talk a little bit about the connection between blues and jazz?
Well, blues and jazz comes out of, you know, gospel music. And, you know, gospel music comes out of Africa. You know, it's the music that the Africans in America made when we were, you know, enslaved. And we took our African forms and put it into the religion that was forced upon us. And then the blues, you know, people who didn't really want to deal with that whole religious thing, people that like to party and drink and chase women and men getting together. The secular forces, you know, they created the blues, and then a little bit later, jazz came about, and the jazz folks were a little bit more, I wouldn't say they were better musicians, but they took it to a higher level, and at that time, I guess the society was such a, in such a way that the jazz musicians became some of the most political people that you could think about, because I remember I had the opportunity of really knowing Max Roach a little bit. I used to speak to Max, Mr. Roach, 3 or 4 times a year, and he was basically telling me, like in the 1940s, there was a man by the name of Cuffy Gunner by Guy Warren, who is a Ghanaian. He said that he brought kente cloth to Charlie Parker and Dizzy Gillespie. Those guys were like wearing kente cloth, like in the 40s. And of course, they looked to Africa. They looked to they were into the African the culturally they went to Africa, but they also supported the liberation movements in Africa as well. And so they had the cultural front and the political front. Max Roach went on to record the song a song in 1960 or 1961, "Freedom Now Sweet," or we chart, or you know. We Insist, Freedom Now Sweet. And then you had people like Randy Weston, who recorded Uhuru Africa in around the same period. And at that particular time, the South African government, since we're talking about South Africa, the South African government banned all of those songs. They banned We Insist Freedom Now Sweet. They banned Randy Weston's Uhuru Africa. They banned Lena Horne's song because it had the title Now in it. Anything that had Now in it, or Freedom or Now, was banned by the South African government in 1964. You can go to Downbeat magazine and they talk about that, and there's been many books that talk about that. So, you know, gospel is Africa is the source, but you know the Africans in America created gospel. Our Weirwood people, who you know got away from the religion thing, created blues, and then the jazz folks took it to a different level in terms of explicitly talking about politics, you know.
Right, Norman. What you talk about gospel, and obviously, like I guess the predecessor to that was like the field hollers and the jump ups.
Yes, sir.
Can you talk about the why music was so important to these enslaved Africans? What kind of role it played in their day-to-day lives? You know, for inspiration, or even to motivate them to rise up and resist. Like, you know, for instance, looking at the Stoner Rebellion, you know, many of those Africans, you know, played the drums as they walked through through South Carolina. What was the importance? And can you also give our listeners a broad, because these Africans came from a place where, you know, drums were very prominent, music was very prominent, different instruments, and when they were enslaved and brought over to different parts of the Western Hemisphere, and just looking at the U.S., you know, focusing on the U.S., correct me if I'm wrong, I believe that music was an aspect of their culture, one of the many aspects of their culture that was ripped away from them. Why was music so important to them, and why was it so important for their slave masters to take away that aspect of their culture?
Well, the drums, basically, I think the Africans in America were banned from African people in America, and music was part of it's functional in African culture. I mean, there's music for when you have a child, there's music. When you get married, there's music. When you go to war, there's music. And the oppressor, he realized that the music was powerful, and they basically tried to stop that. But in the fields, I don't know if they made a mistake, but you know they allowed, or the Africans could sing, you know, I guess to break the monotony. And I can imagine that many of them probably like what they heard, you know, because a lot of racist folks love African music, you know what I mean? Because, I mean, there's a whole lot of rednecks who like Bob Marley right now. I mean, you know, like if you deal with the appeal of Bob Marley, that's worldwide we're talking about, all over Europe and so on and so forth. And even today, a lot of our people, a lot of African people in the whole Western Hemisphere don't care anything about blues, but they love blues in Europe today, Japan, you know, in many parts of the world. So I hope that answered what I'm trying to answer. I hope that answered what you wanted to know.
Definitely, it definitely does.
Thank you, Norman. This is Tim again. I wanted to know what role have the events in society determined what artists like James Brown, The Last Poets, or Joe Scott Heron performed in their music?
Oh, I think that the artist has been influenced by the movement, by the conditions. And there is a new book out called Party Music by Vincent, Ricky Vincent, and he basically talked about how, you know, the Black Panther Party had a group called the Lumpin', and they were responding to the, not just them, but they were responding to the events of the day, you know. And I think that if you take a music like Calypso and you take a music like reggae, they are not, were not under the corporate capitalist situation. And I think they served as the music served as like newspapers, although reggae music had a lot of lovey-dovey type of stuff. It still had another element of you know, the whole revolutionary thing, whereas in the United States of America, you had an industry, so you had a choice. First of all, they didn't want African people to use music to in America to use music to promote any kind of struggle. So they put they had the Africans basically trying to get a hit record. So in order to get a hit record, you're not going to try to offend the record companies, or you're trying to sell records, even though a lot of the corporations didn't even care about African music in the beginning. But I think the African folks, the music has, the movement always influenced the music and not the other way around. You know, James Brown was responding to the conditions. You know, Rap Brown says that he basically, he put some heat on James Brown, and James Brown came out with, "Say it loud, I'm black and I'm proud." I believe that's true.
Thank you. I wanted to look at jazz, and if you could talk about, this is kind of a loaded question, if you could talk about the brilliance of some of the artists that in jazz that you know, you're really have a lot of adoration for, whether it's, you know, the brilliance of Coltrane or Miles or Dizzy, what have you. And if you could talk about how some of these African jazz artists, you know, how they came to, you know, because I know some of them, you know, died, you know, penniless or close to penniless, or you know, or just never even received the profits that they deserved. And you know, in comparison to, you know, white folks and white corporations that now own their music and have really profited from these other artists. Because one of the things that you know, I you know, hate seeing is, like, you know, people prop up like the likes of Kenny G as jazz, and this guy, I mean, this guy is talentless, you know, I don't know, you know what, and you know, he's making more money than Coltrane or Dizzy or Miles, you know what I'm saying, you know ever did, you know what I'm saying, and he's got, you know, they had more talent in their little pinkies than he has in his entire body.
Well, I'll just say this about first before I answer the question. I remember seeing Peabo Bryson one time, and I became real close with Peabo Bryson. But Peabo Bryson asked me to help his sister get into the concert, and this was a concert with Peabo Bryson and Kenny G, and they were supposed to be co-headlining. So Peabo Bryson, she had an accident, so she was on a, you know, had a walker, had a walking stick, and she was basically cursing like cursing like Sarah Vaughan. She was calling, you know, what is my brother doing with this no playing, blah, 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 talking about Kenny G. But, yeah, Kenny G is another story. But in terms of the jazz musicians, one of the persons that has really inspired me was Archie Shepp. Now, Archie Shepp, I named my show Diasporic Music as a result of basically talking to him. Diasporic music is the music that African people made outside of Africa. But my show, I do play African music, but diasporic music, or I guess the proper English would be diasporic music, but I say diasporic music, would embrace everything from Bessie Smith to Burning Spear and I could play everything from samba to hip-hop, you know, so it's broad, 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 broad. Also, I could play music from the English-speaking, French-speaking, Dutch-speaking, the Spanish, the whole, all the language, all the colonizers that took us, we created music, you know, from all those territories. But Archie Shepp came up with the term diasporic music, so I use the term diasporic music. But I met Archie Shepp, and I saw him the first time, I think, in the Spirit House in Newark, New Jersey. And in Newark, New Jersey. And then I began to I didn't meet him at that particular time because, to be perfectly honest, I was basically underground at that particular time, you know, running from the draft. But when I finally – he used to write a column in the Downbeat magazine, and he talked about being anti-war, pro-Vietnam, you know, because we – Ho Chi Minh wrote articles about lynching. Ho Chi Minh lived in the United States. Ho Chi Minh used to go to UNIA meetings. So, you know, I learned a lot of stuff from Archie Shepp's. About, you know, struggles of other people, and the whole concept of diasporic music, you know, I got from him. And I saw him last year in Los Angeles. You know, I hadn't seen him in many years. And he is a guy who, the way he is surviving is he lives in Paris now, you know. He doesn't even live in the United States. Coltrane, to give you a good story, Coltrane didn't die broke. Coltrane had his publishing together, but he is a rarity. Dizzy, I think, might have made some money, and Max might have made some money because Max, you know, taught school and so on and so forth. But there are exceptions to the rule. Most of the most brilliant musicians died broke, and the publishing was owned by some Euro-Americans or some other Euro people from Germany, so on and so forth, and they are benefiting from all of these creations.
Thank you, Norman. This is Tim again. I wanted to ask you, in 2012, you wrote an open letter to President Obama titled, "What About We People Who Are Darker Than Blue?" Could you tell us what that open letter consisted of and why you wrote it?
Basically, I wrote the letter because June is Black Music Month, and going back to 79, I believe, or 78, Dizzy Gillespie, Max Roach, Little Richard, Evelyn Champagne King, Kenny Gamble, there's a woman named Dina Williams. I want to give her credit. I think she's in Philly. They went to Washington, D.C., and President Carter proclaimed June Black Music Month. And, you know, in the early 80s, late 70s, early 80s, record company used to give out samples of Black music. They took ads out in magazines. June is Black Music Month. La da 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 da. Then it died out. And when President Barack Hussein Obama was elected president, he changed it to African American Music Appreciation Month, which basically took the Pan-African or the international element out. And when the Black Music Association began, one of the things that they did was they put together Bob Marley and Stevie Wonder. If you go back and there's photographs that were taken by Kwame Brathwaite, who is the brother of Ilombe Brath. He took these photos of Bob Marley and Stevie Wonder, very iconic photographs. And one of the things that the BMA was trying to do was to unite all forms of Black music. And And, you know, you had some of the jazz musicians that were upset because they didn't think they were getting enough credit. You had, you know, some calypso folks that, you know, were upset. And maybe the jazz musicians and the calypsonians may have had a point, but the point was that the Black Music Association was trying to deal with black music, period, and not just rhythm and blues, jazz, and gospel, but they wanted to deal with it, even the African beats, because Dick Griffey, who was the head of the Black Music Association, we were attempting to have the Black Music Association convention in Lagos, Nigeria, but that never happened because of, I think at that time there was a lot of politics going on, and there was a lot of people didn't want to go to Africa, because some people didn't want to go because they thought it was unstable. Other people didn't want to go because they didn't want to have anything to do with Africa. But is there another point you want to make about that?
No, just wanted to just get your reflection on that piece, because we were telling our listeners that, you know, that's one of the places where they can find your writings is Black Agenda Report. I remember that piece came out. I remember reading that piece when it first came out, and I was really appreciative that you addressed that issue within the open letter, because I thought the piece that you wrote was very on point, spot on.
Could I say that Archie Shepp made the point that what Malcolm played, Coltrane. What Malcolm said, Coltrane played, and he pointed out the fact that, you know, in the 60s you had Malcolm and Train, and in the 70s you had Bob Marley and Walter Rodney, and then later on you had, you had Fela and Thomas Sankara, you know, sort of going back and forth to the politics and the music complementing one another.
Thank you. And so in that same vein, I wanted to ask you, because, you know, some of our listeners are younger, and, you know, this kind of plays in par for a question that I'm going to ask after this question. But I wanted to first ask you if you could shed some light on some of the artists that you can think of, some of the African artists that you can think of, you know, whether they were American-born Africans or if they're in South, places like South Africa, like Mary Makeba, artists that you can think of that did not shy away from addressing politics or political struggle, you know, or liberation, not just in their music, but also in their rhetoric when they were asked these questions. And I would say, I would also put in the vein, in terms of musicians, you know, he was a musician with his voice, you know, Paul Robeson. So if you could answer that question.
Well, I guess the first one I would have to say would be Fela Kuti out of Nigeria, was very, very, very outspoken. And I had the pleasure of meeting Fela on many occasions, and I actually went to his home and to the Calcutta Republic, and I found that Fela Kuti was basically, he credits Los Angeles with basically turning him on, to Pan-Africanism. Those are his words, not mine. I also think of Peter Tosh, who I think has been really neglected. I was talking to one of my best friends from Antigua, who can't stand Peter. I don't know why, but yeah, he says, I was basically saying, you know, Peter Tosh could play every instrument, and he just said that Peter was just an angry black man. But I think Peter Tosh was, one of my favorites. Marion Makeba. I love Mary Makeba because, she stood for the liberation of not only South Africans but Africans. Period. She had passports from, I don't know how many passports she had, from Guinea, from Algeria, all kind of passports, because you know people loved her. I like Mighty Sparrow. He has a kind of a mixed bag, but a lot of things Sparrow did, he was way ahead of his time. That song "Slave," I think, is a is classic. Abby Lincoln, Aminata Museka, the work she did with Max Roach, and I can't. Max Roach is special, but Aminata Museka, I don't think she gets the credit that she deserves. Of course, Nina Simone. Nina Simone, I can't say enough about Nina Simone.
Can I do the rock crowd?